Housing Finance Agency and Revenue Bonding Program.
On the issuance of revenue bonds to finance low and medium income housing, and the purpose of the meeting this morning is primarily to have demonstrated to the committee the need for this housing. When we scheduled this meeting, we anticipated the Senate was going to continue to convene at 11 a.m., but yesterday we decided we were going to convene at 10 a.m., and it was too late to try to change the notices, and I apologize for the limited time we have. Now, there are people here from the Division of Housing of the Department of Commerce, and we'll proceed with them first, and as you know, all of our the hearing is recorded, and so that we can communicate with you, I shall appreciate it if you state your name and address so we know how to reach you. Thank you.
I'm Betty Nivens, and
not from the department.
The easiest way to communicate with me is through the Department of Commerce, although I am not employed by the Department of Commerce. I'm chairman of the State Housing Council, which is advisory to the department. And all I'm going to do this morning is to put the division in perspective a little bit for people who might not be aware of how it came into being and what it does. And then I'm going to leave the floor to these gentlemen to tell you exactly how things stand. Before the passage of Senate Bill 22, and I'm sorry, but that's what it is for everybody. We're talking about Senate Bill 22 in 1971 session. The state of housing in the state was rather chaotic. There was very little organized activity or recognition of need or ability to know what to do about it after you knew you had a need, except in Salem and Eugene. There was some activity in Portland where there are a great many nonprofit sponsorships were started, and most of them failed. They failed in large measure because they didn't have the benefit of advice from a division of housing. And unfortunately, from that point of view, we really should have started a division of housing in 1969 and not in 1971, because the doctor arrived a little too late for those, but not too late for everybody. The functions that were given to, required of, the division of housing by the 1971 legislation related to providing basic information and training, technical assistance, and created a revolving fund to help sponsors. And these will be dealt with in much more detail by Greg Smith, who is the administrator of the division, and also by Doug Stevie, who is our data analyst. One of the biggest problems before the 1970 census was that we really had almost no information about small areas. One of the accomplishments of the Division of Housing has been that we have moved out into the state and have been able to create awareness and to do something, not nearly as much as needs to be done, not nearly as much as we would have liked to, but do something in far-flung places like Enterprise and Talent, which isn't so far-flung, but it's pretty far-flung compared with where we were before on all these things. The question might arise as to what the division is going to do in the absence of federal funding for 18 months, and we feel there are plenty of things to be done even if the funds are frozen for 18 months. It's important for us to play a role in improving the management of existing subsidized housing that's been a problem. It's still necessary to prepare communities to be able to do what can be done with whatever programs finally come out of the federal government. It's very important that the division be prepared to act as the recipient of federal funds, because this seems to be the course that the administration is taking, namely that when there are new programs, they will be coming to states to then be channeled into the local area. We don't know this for certain, but this seems to be the pattern. With the freezing of the funds is more important than ever, of course, to develop some kind of state capability for creating housing and not be totally dependent on federal funds. We knew that before. We had in mind the revenue bonding bill before there was any fund freeze, because we knew we were not getting enough housing through federal programs. But the need is more crying than before. I mentioned briefly that the federal programs for moderate income, which would be the closest as far as corresponding to what we would do under the revenue bonding bill, produced $144 million in construction in the state in the 3 years from 70 to 72. Clearly, this is a benefit to the state as well as to people who are living in that housing, and clearly if we can sustain construction rather than having it take ups and downs with the federal program, it would be a good thing for the state of Oregon. The other kind of thing that we're trying to do as far as helping people who are in difficulties with high housing costs is supporting relief for renters. And in fact, I am going to take my leave and go over to the Revenue Committee and once again make a pitch over there for being sure that they do the most they can with the scope of the governor's bill, or even better, I hope, than that. And, so I'll turn the field over to the real people.
Thank you, Betty. Are there any questions of Ms. What could you just, you say there were unsuccessful efforts on the part of nonprofit groups in Portland in the period of time between 1969 and 71?
Yeah, well, the particular period when they tended to be falling apart was right around 1970-71. A great many were organized, and there was nobody to tell them exactly how to do it, how hard it was to do, that they needed to get some expert counsel and not try to fly alone. And so the attrition rate, not just in Portland, but it was in Portland where there were the most, therefore this is where it was most noticeable that they fell apart.
These were generally one project efforts, were they not?
Well, I don't, if they'd ever gotten the first project off the ground, Keith, I'm sure they hoped to be more than one project efforts, but they didn't get that far.
They turned out being no project efforts.
They turned out being no project efforts, unfortunately.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. My name is Greg Smith. I'm the administrator of the State Housing Division, and in order to keep our program within the time limits before us, I'm going to cut quite a bit. I will pass out one little sheet that relates to the Housing Division, what we're supposed to be doing, and the activities that we have pursued. The basic goal of the State Housing Division is to stimulate and increase the supply of low and moderate income housing in Oregon. Now, in order to accomplish that, we were provided in our legislation with four basic functions: to provide information on housing programs and needs to local groups that needed this information so that they could set priorities and develop programs at the local level. Provide training programs at the local level, provide on-site technical assistance, and seed money loans. And if you look at this little chart that I've just handed you, it shows the ORS quote, plus the staff that we have, plus the funding, where the money is coming from. And you may note that we had to come up with quite a bit of federal funds in order to pursue the activities demanded of us by our legislation. We were fortunate enough to obtain three federal grants to fit into our areas of responsibility, and have been pursuing those with a great deal of vigor over the last year or so. We produced a slide presentation, which I think I have time to show you, and that's about all I'll show you, and then we'll let our housing planner talk about housing needs in the state. But if you'll bear with me for about 10 or so minutes, I'd like to show you a slide presentation that we put together for our training programs on housing needs in Oregon. And we realize there's a problem with the skylight above, but I think we can project it on the screen, and maybe maybe you'll see some of the things in here that we've seen in the field and get a better feeling for what it is we're trying to accomplish.
Could someone catch the lights, please?
Well, that's why you're on the fourth floor.
This is Oregon. A state we're proud of. Oregon has a lot to offer. Sports, recreation, a beautiful landscape, productive farmland, and progressive cities that provide good community services. There are shopping centers that cater to our needs, and fine residential areas for families to grow up in. Yes, life is enjoyable here in Oregon. There's camping in the fall, skiing in the winter, the beach during the summer. Yes, Oregon offers its citizens a way of life we can be proud of. Or does it? For some, Oregon does not offer an adequate place to live. People live here with overcrowding, inadequate or non-existent sanitary facilities, poor heating, rotting foundations, leaky roofs, poor water supply, and dangerous wiring. The result of bad housing can be tragic. But is the problem really serious? Yes, it is really serious. Approximately 198,000 people live in substandard housing here in the state of Oregon. This substandard housing is likely to be located in rural areas. And most of it is occupied by native Oregonians, people who have lived here all their lives. But substandard housing is only part of the problem. Many people live in standard housing, but spend such a large percentage of their income for it that they can't afford other basic necessities such as nutrition and health care. A mother and her three children spend 42% of their income for a studio apartment in this building. That leaves her $125 a month to live on. This trailer is home for a 59-year-old disabled man who pays 37% of his $100 a month income for rental space and utilities. That leaves him $63 a month to live on. A 49-year-old disabled woman spends 70% of her income to live in the house on the left. That leaves her $26 a month to live on. The housing in these examples is not substandard, but what about the quality of life for people who have to spend such a large percentage of their income for shelter? One renter household in every seven in Oregon spends more than the recommended one quarter of its income for rent. And it's those who can least afford it who pay the highest percentage of their income for housing. At one end of this graph, nearly all of the renters with annual incomes below $2,000 spend over 35% of their income on housing. At the other end, where incomes are over $10,000, the majority of renters spend less than 10% of their income on housing. The point is that families who are forced to spend more than one quarter of their income for adequate shelter are usually low-income families who must cut back on other basic needs in order to keep a roof over their heads. But the shortage of housing at a reasonable cost also affects families in moderate income ranges. Why? Because in 1965, housing costs, since 1965, housing costs have increased much faster than the general standard of living. Those who know about household finance say that a family with an income of $7,500 should look for a house costing no more than $15,000. But we are building few houses in that price range anymore. In 1970, less than 1 in 10 of the new homes built in Oregon cost less than $15,000. Thus, the moderate income family is beginning to feel the housing squeeze also. What kind of people fall within this moderate income category? Well, the state average for starting secondary school teachers is $6,900. The average clerk typist makes $4,100. The average farm laborer, $4,300. If these moderate income people have a family to support, Oregon is not an easy place to find a home. Yet we know we must find reasonably priced housing for those who teach our children and perform necessary services. At the same time, we must provide decent housing for those who have no choice but to live in substandard housing. To respond to the housing problem in Oregon, the 1971 legislature created a housing division within the Department of Commerce. The purpose of the division was to stimulate housing production for low and moderate income families. As a first step, the housing division assembled a small staff to assist local groups in developing solutions to local housing needs. Detailed housing analysis of all cities and counties in Oregon have been prepared to pinpoint areas of greatest need. Training sessions are held to provide the most up-to-date information on housing programs and techniques. On-site technical assistance is provided to housing sponsors to help them through the maze of regulations. And seed money loans are made to nonprofit groups seeking to produce low and moderate income housing in their communities. Our first loan assisted the Sorgenfrei Nord project in Eugene, sponsored by the Lutheran Layman of Lane County. With strong local initiative, plus state and federal support, we can begin to solve our housing problem here in Oregon. We're proud of this. Let's do something about this. That's the end of the slide presentation. That's something we use to kind of lead into our training session and set the stage. I'd like to pass out three things at this point, and then we'll get right down to talking about specific needs by various localities. I'd like you to look at is on this long sheet of paper. Now, many people wonder whether or not there's a housing problem and why it seems to have come upon us so recently. If you look at this particular graph, you see a comparison of the increase of all consumer prices with those of food and home ownership between 1960 and 1972. starting in about 1965, the lines begin to diverge, and this red line, which represents home ownership costs, begins to diverge from the general consumer price index down here. And when you get to 1972, you see the enormous gap that's there and in fact growing between what an average family is likely to have in terms of income and what it's going to have to pay to own a home. Now this trend is continuing.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, before we get too far away from it, Greg, you made a statement that I want you to clarify. You said that 198,000 Oregonians live in substandard housing. Now, how do you define standard or substandard housing?
I'd
like to respond to that because I cover that in my portion of the presentation, the definition of substandard.
You will cover
yes,
it.
Yes, I will.
All right.
Basically, it's the census definition, the U.S. Census definition.
I just didn't want to lose that.
No. All right. The second thing I'd like you to look at is this little chart called construction costs, which is taken from a real estate foundation publication published in Portland, which looks at an average new three-bedroom home in Oregon, in Portland, in the Portland metropolitan area, what it's cost to produce since 1955. And it shows that in 1955, that unit would have cost $12,000. In September of 1972, the same unit would cost $21,400. The last thing I'd like you to look at is this third sheet, which says average price of newly constructed housing in Oregon, which breaks down between conventionally financed and FHA insured, starts at 1966 and goes to 1971. As you can see, whether it be conventionally financed or FHA insured, the trend is markedly up at somewhere around 7.5% to 8%. And if you project that out over the next 7 years to 1980, you see that in 1980, if these trends continue, the average conventionally financed new home in Oregon is going to sell for $45,000, and the average FHA insured $40,000. And that is just a simple little calculation projecting that 7.5% out over the next 7 years. I would like to stop with that. I had several other things that I wanted to talk to you about, but I think that we ought to move right now into Doug Stevie's presentation. Mr. Stevie is the housing planner on our staff, and I might say that he's only been on board 8 days, so this is going to be an ordeal by fire for him, but I'm sure he's adequately prepared. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Doug.
Okay.
Yes.
Before I go, I would like you to correct two things that you said that I'm afraid
All right.
may have caused some confusion in what you read. One in every seven Oregon households is spending over 25% of income for rent, not one in every seven Oregon renters. All the households in Oregon, one in seven will be a renter household spending over 25% for rent. And the other way around, the figures would have to do with the people under 2,000 who spend over 35% for housing. This is for rent. And the incomes of 10,000 to spend 10% or less, that's for rent. Because if you pick it up the other way, you all know that people with incomes over 10,000, if you're buying a house, are spending more than 10% of your income for it. So it's important to get those straightened out. And in particular, if we have any press coverage on it, we don't want it to come out the first time around all
Both those points are
wrong.
In the script. I was going
yeah.
over it so fast.
I didn't want to bar you from the script.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Betty, we have some modest effort being made in Portland, particularly insofar as public housing is concerned, and rent supplement and various federal programs in various parts of the city. Now, does that one in seven figure include all those households, too?
Yes.
And without those households, which are in these federally subsidized programs, and even the, well, the Portland Housing Authority, how does the figure differ?
One of the hardest things in the world to get is accurate information from the Department of Housing and Urban Development in Portland as to exactly how many units there are of anything in Oregon. But there are roughly, I believe, roughly 8,000 units of public housing in Oregon at this point. And in the moderate income programs, there are of the order of, find the one on which I've done the addition.
Half of those public housing units are in Portland.
Well, have you struck an average
by
of what percentage of the monthly income that people pay in those subsidized programs?
Oh, well, by definition now, they can't pay more than 25% by the Brook Amendment.
Do some of them pay up to 25%?
You bet your boots, every one of them pays up to 25%, unless in some cases they're getting money from the Housing Authority, because the 25% is supposed to include their utilities. If their utilities cost more than 25% of their income, the Housing Authority has to give them some money to pay for their utilities, which is putting the Housing Authority, some of them, in the red. It's a mess.
Well, my point, Mr. Chairman, is, and of course I've got great respect for you and mutual interest in this, but I don't think that the statistics are accurate unless they're separated from the housing units which are subsidized by public agencies.
They would be underestimated.
Yeah,
we've been endeavoring to do that. One comment I might make is that at the time that the census data was collected, that 25% limit did not apply, and there were people in public housing who were paying 50 or 60% of their income for rent, because the Brook Amendment was not yet in effect. So the main thing is that when you look at the figures that say there are rentals available for under 40 or 40 to 60, you need to take away from those all the ones that are represented by subsidized rentals. That doesn't mean that there are that many rentals, or were that many rentals in the private market available at those rates. And we are trying desperately to do what you're talking about, John, namely to be able to take the to deduct those subsidized housing units in order to be a little bit more accurate about the numbers, but it does get worse.
Betty, you've been working, I know, very hard on the tax question. I wonder if you could relate to us the property tax portion of the rents or the cost of housing. The property tax has gone up 120% in the last 10 years, so what can we relate that to this problem?
Yes,
because when you pay rent, property tax is in the rent.
Well, the only figure I can give you is a national figure. Nationally, from 1963 to 1971, the average housing cost per month for under the FHA standard program went up 35%, and the property tax went up 89%. So the property taxes have been going up at a much greater rate than the other parts of the cost of housing.
What's that again? Do that again.
30, that's probably on the material that Rusty's going to give you, if you can find it in the vast amount. But the increase from 63 to 71 was 35% in monthly payments.
You have it in the handout I've handed out to you already. We'll go through it.
Well, I just assumed get it from her. Might not have time to read it.
And the increase of the in property taxes in that same period was 89%.
Mr. Chairman, one more question. You've indicated that these are national figures.
Yeah.
Doesn't relate to the problem that Oregon had the fourth highest property tax
This
is actually even larger here.
Things are likely to be worse in Oregon, right, than they are nationally. So, and I'll.
I have a question.
Yeah.
You used the term moderate income, and I think that was
I can respond to that, generally, we've taken the federal definitions of low and moderate income. And generally, when the federal government talks about low income, they mean people with incomes below $3,600 annual income, zero to 3,600, roughly. It depends upon family size and location and a number of factors. And then between 36 and roughly 8,000, you've got another category that's often called moderate, in which programs such as the 236 multifamily rental program, the 235 single family rental program, or single family home ownership program tend to function. But they're rather fuzzy concepts.
They don't just say poor to moderate, they also have, they break it down by how many dependents they have and so forth, but I think probably everybody would agree with it now. Anybody supporting a family of 4,100 should be the classification of being low or poor.
Just to tell you what this last thing was that I passed out, this is some older data. It's from the 1968 Kaiser Commission report on housing, and it broke down cost components in single family and rental units. And it does show what the various cost components are, including taxes. But these were national figures. They were collected in 1968. I'm not sure they have any particular relevance, although the general breakdown may be fairly accurate. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Doug Stevie then.
Well, as Mr. Smith has already pointed out, Oregon does indeed have a housing problem. The problem of that, barring prompt remedial action, will only worsen in years to come. During my portion of the presentation, I would like to submit the problem to an in-depth analysis and to limit those factors which have given rise to the present state of affairs. The police of the committee will refer to the handout I've placed on each desk called Housing Characteristics in Oregon.
It's the thick one.
Yeah, all right. Okay. We needed 11, though. Can't.
If you'll follow through on these handouts as I go through them, I'd appreciate it. And you can analyze the handouts in depth at your leisure. If we all have a copy now, we will begin. On page 1, you'll find tables 6 and 7. Now, these tables are taken out of other documents, and you think I'll have to start with table 6, if that's why. You'll see that this page shows the change in supply of owner-occupied housing by value ranges and the change in supply of rental housing by rent ranges. A particular note here is the fact that the greatest changes, both absolute and relative terms, have occurred in homes valued at more than $15,000. And in rental units running for more than 100 per month. I think this is quite obvious if you look at the percentage change category. As of 1970, for example, homes and or rental units within reach of households with incomes of less than $5,000 per year were in short supply. Tables 11 and 12 on page 2.
What does this minus 83 or minus 68 mean? 68% of what?
Well, that means that there was a net decrease, the decrease in that many units. In other words, the number of units valued at less than 5,000 decreased from 34,000 to 10,000, or decreased by 68%, where you see a minus figure. So not only are we getting more and more units above 15,000, we're getting less and less units below 10. In this case, we'll actually below 13.
Now, is there any attempt to relate in terms of real dollars, or are you just talking in terms of stated dollars? What I'm trying to say is that it could be deceptive in looking at a comparison over 10 years to say, well, we have only 75% as many houses that are worth $5,000 now that we had 10 years ago. It may be exactly the same houses, but they've simply gone up in dollar value. Do you do anything in here to cover that?
Well, as we go on here a bit, I'll get to that. I certainly understand your point. In other words, you're saying that the entire index has gone up, and hence we're really talking about inflation and not about an increase.
Yeah, and so figures like this could be very misleading if you take them at face value.
Well, I think as we go along, you'll see that it's not simply an inflationary trend that's being, and the incomes are keeping up with.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in response to Senator Cook's question, are these figures, can you tell us now whether these figures are in terms of real or stated dollars?
No, we can't.
Well, they're not in terms of constant dollars. They are not.
In terms of inflated dollars.
Right.
Okay, the tables on page two, tables 11 and 12, further demonstrate that rental costs have increased dramatically and show that over 80%, which would be in table 12, of the rental units built between 1969 and 70 rented for amounts which could be considered excessive for households making less than $5,000 per year. Now, these are real rents, but they're relating to people with real incomes, and hence the inflationary trend is considered on both sides. We're talking about absolute terms here. In other words, those people making less than $5,000 today cannot afford the bulk of the rental units built between 1969 and 1970. So this reduces it to, this takes inflation into account on both sides, and hence balances out the equation that you referred to in the earlier page. Tables located on pages 3 and 4 illustrate that this prospective homeowner has fared no better. As shown in table 15 on page 3, the average housing expense on homes covered by FHA section 203 mortgages increased by over 83% between 1960 and 70. And if you notice on the fifth entry down, that's the property tax figure referred to by Ms. Niven. Likewise, table 16 shows that mortgage payments and monthly housing expenses have increased at a faster rate than have the annual effective incomes of buyers. Again, this brings the inflationary thing into balance. Incomes have simply not kept up with expenses. And so you're talking about conditions that exist today and not simply arbitrary figures applied to ever increasing incomes. In 1960, for example, a family or individual could purchase a home valued at almost twice their yearly income, or a ratio of 1.921. This is the value income ratio fifth row down. Whereas a ratio of 1.65:1 is now considered to be more realistic in view of the increased total monthly housing expenses. While it should be mentioned that these figures contained in tables 15 and 16 are based on national rather than state data, we can see from the table on page 5 that they are relevant for Oregon.
Why don't you break down interest? I notice over here on page 3 you don't break interest out.
Well, this is simply the information we have. We have to work with what is available. Those figures are not available to us at this time, and with the interest breakdown.
Whereabouts did you get it?
Well, the bottom shows the source. It's the HUD Statistical Yearbook, U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, 1970.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure those figures must be available somewhere.
Were you referring to page 3?
Yeah.
Table 15?
3 and 4.
Without the interest figures, again, it's an incomplete thing. I'd really like to have the figures so we can compare interest taxes. I bet interest has gone up faster than taxes.
All right, we'll certainly get that information for you.
I can give you one thing, Senator Cook. I don't know whether it totally answers the question, but this particular handout here, if you look, it's an index of new single-family homes, a series of indices looking at things like average cost, wholesale price index, union hourly wage rates, and building trades. And the last item is the average interest rate on conventional first mortgages between 1966 and 1972. And those are national figures again, but they do show that it's gone up about 1.25% nationally. Yeah. It's actually gone up a little higher in Oregon.
Right, well, I think it's important that be brought out. The increase of property taxes is usually exaggerated, in my observation. And so I think it's important that we compare it with the increase in other things, particularly the most important single factor in the increase of housing, I suspect, which is interest.
Greg, weren't you charged with the responsibility in the last, since your division was created, with compiling an inventory for Oregon? And if you were, why didn't you get those figures for Oregon rather than just copying these out of the HUD statistical yearbook?
What we've done is we've analyzed the 1970 census in as much detail as we can analyze it. And we have computer printouts about yay thick, about 40 documents, which we've gone through and pulled out relevant information on such things as income levels, housing characteristics, and so on. But the census, unfortunately, which is the single most important database that we have, doesn't look at things like interest rates or consumer price indices. It's very difficult, for example, to get figures on constant dollars. I tried to do this one time because I had a similar question as your Senator Cook. And I called Washington, D.C., and I wrote lots of letters trying to get some sort of market basket equation, so that I could figure out for our state what the constant dollars were over the last decade, and finally gave up in frustration. No federal agency keeps those sorts of figures, and if they keep them, they only keep them for large regional areas. The western region, which is one of the smaller breakdowns that the Commerce Department has on index figures, includes the Rocky Mountain states and all of the Pacific Northwest states, and that's about as small as you can get on many of these things. So it's a question of what kind of data we can get. And other, in order to get things like interest rates, we can get them by asking local savings and loans, say, well, by doing.
Did you?
We haven't done that on interest rates up to this point.
I mean, it'd be an extraordinarily simple thing to do, and you have a figure for Oregon, and the same with the building trade rate, and the same with the property tax.
There, for example, on the building trade index there, I talked to a gentleman in Washington, D.C. just yesterday and was trying to get more precise data, and they simply couldn't.
Why couldn't you call the AFL-CIO here and not incur the expense of a long-distance call? I mean, it seems to me that you should be talking to people here and not in Washington.
Any other questions?
Okay, this table we referred to, table 17 on page 5, shows that over 32,000 households, and this is in the case in the heavy black line, if it comes to 10,000 to 15,000 per year owned homes, valued between 15,000 and 20,000. In other words, in Oregon, nationally, this group represents the largest segment of the homeowners, and this would refer back to the HUD statistics. I would also like to say that Senator Burns has an excellent point about using Oregon-based data. Now we've looked at some of the housing trends. to see how they have affected the state's homeowners and renters. Diagram on page 6 shows the distribution by income of the state's low and moderate income households that are paying more than 25% of their annual earnings for rent. Of these, approximately 64,400 have annual incomes of less than 5,000 and are classified as low income in need. An additional 11,800 have annual incomes between 5 and 10,000, or 5 and 8,000, I'm sorry, that are classified as moderately low income in need. The graph on the following page shows the distribution of those households with respect to their demographic characteristics. As you can readily see, the vast majority fall within the categories of single under 65 years, single over 65 years, and families under 30. This is true of both the low and the moderately low income groupings. There's a misprint on this page. You'll note that this should be 11A instead of...
You're on page 7?
Yeah.
Where is this?
11A. This should be 11A.
Which one should be 11A?
On page 7, the right-hand category, households with incomes between 5 and 10. Now, if you want to know what the distribution is for 5 to 8, figures Mr. Smith mentioned earlier, it would be 11.8 as opposed to 15.8. If you want to use
that total figure right here that now says $15,811
would be 11.8 if you're considering those households only 5 and 8,000.
5 and 8,000?
Yeah, between 5 and 8,000. That 15.8 is for households with incomes between 5 and 10,000. We have made a revision. This table was pulled up before our definition of moderately low was reevaluated. This graph is especially significant when one considers the fact that, relatively speaking, Oregon's population is increasing fastest in the 0 to 24 and the 65 and over categories. At this point, if you refer back to page 5, we will look at those homeowner households determined to be in need. You need concentrate only on those entries set off by the heavy black line. As you can see, they represent those households with annual incomes between 5 and 10,000 that own homes valued at more than 10 but less than 35,000. You will also note that for each category, the value to income ratio is greater than 2 to 1. As has already been mentioned, the ratio of this magnitude is unreasonably high by today's standards and indicates that the homeowners involved are in all likelihood burdened with excessively high monthly housing expenses. This means, for comparative purposes, that more than 54,000 homeowner households, or approximately 15% of the state's total, are in need. You may also have noticed that I have made no mention of those homeowner households with gross incomes of less than $5,000 per year, even though their housing value to income ratio is, in all categories, unreasonably high. This omission was made on purpose because it was felt that for them to maintain ownership in the first place, they would have to, one, live in homes that are already paid for, two, no longer be making mortgage payments, or three, be recipients of generous property tax relief. Likewise, we have eliminated those households with incomes greater than $10,000 on the assumption that they are living in more expensive housing as a matter of choice. Certainly, whenever you make an assumption, there is a risk of error. We are confident, however, that if an error has been made, it is because we have underestimated the need and not because we have exaggerated. In addition to the economic factors, we should also look at the housing problem in terms of substandard and overcrowded units. We had a question about what is meant by a substandard earlier. On page 8, you'll find a map which shows the number of substandard units, or those units having inadequate plumbing or heating or both, by county.
You've now substituted inadequate the word substandard, and that doesn't help me.
Okay, what's meant by those? We're talking about no plumbing is considered inadequate plumbing. That's, we're using only those units with no plumbing. For inadequate heating.
You mean a well outside?
Huh?
You mean not a faucet in the house, a well outside?
Any external, where they have to go outside to get water, is considered, or lacking sanitary facilities, this is considered inadequate. Now, when they talk about inadequate heating, they're talking about things, and this is again based on census things, such as fireplaces, heaters without flues, and things of that nature. Now, this is all broken down in the fourth count census data. If you'd like a breakdown, is exactly what they mean. I'm glad you provided.
Well, of course, I can think of some of the fanciest places in Oregon don't match those two. They have neither fireplaces nor flues because they're electric heat. Now,
well, the electric heat is not considered to be substandard.
So if they have electric heat, even if it's a heater, what I'm getting at is that I have the same feeling we're buying the HUD, or I take no comfort, apparently, there you do, and perhaps maybe you have to, in taking the census data.
For example, when we're talking about a home with a fireplace, we're not talking about all homes with fireplaces being substandard heating. We're talking about homes with only fireplaces as being substandard. We talk about a heater without a flue. We're not talking about an electric heater. We're talking about wood fired or coal fired heaters without flues.
Okay.
The census definition basically looks at a structure and says, does it have a heating system? And if it has no heating system, then it's considered to be lacking adequate heating. That is, if it's a house built with only a wall outlet for an electric space heater, then that would be considered as one of the houses lacking adequate heating. But, or the same thing with a fireplace. If it were a cabin and the only system of heating it had was a stone fireplace. But again, these are census definitions.
Does this include temporary housing?
No, these are year-round units.
All year-round units.
Could we get a copy of what the census data is, how they determine this, and very helpful?
Certainly.
What you say?
You use the term substandard, you use the term inadequate.
No. Substandard units are those units composed of either inadequate plumbing, inadequate heating, or
any
both.
One.
Any one, or both.
Yeah, let me ask you. How much longer do you think you can?
Well, not very long. We can run through it pretty quick.
5 minutes?
No, I think we can do it in
5 minutes. Okay.
You can go to 4 and a half.
4 and a half. Well, okay. We'll just go right on through. Now, as I say, on page 8, you find a map of substandard units, a number of substandard units by county. These units total more than 93,000, represent nearly 14% of the state's total year-round housing units. Understandably, they're located primarily in the Willamette Valley counties. The map on page 9, however, shows that substandardness is a statewide problem and is, in relative terms, greatest in the central and southern Oregon counties. On page 10, the table on page 10 shows the number of persons per room of livable space in state renter and occupied housing units. By looking at the entries contained with the heavy black line, or those units with more than one person per room of livable space, you can see that 37,000 units, or nearly 6% of all occupied units, are overcrowded. Of these, approximately 8,000 have more than 1.5 persons per room in livable space and are classified as being severely overcrowded. The maps on pages 11 and 12 respectively show the number and the percentage of renter households below the median income paying more than 25% of their income for gross rent. As with substandardness, the greatest numbers are to be found in Willamette Valley County. Relatively speaking, however, this would be on page 12, they are located more or less uniformly throughout the state. Now that we have looked at the state's housing problems in terms of its component parts, you're probably wondering what all this means in terms of additional units. That's just...
I think we better adjourn the call. Sorry. Our next meeting is on February 15th. It's going to be at 8:30 in the morning. And I appreciate it. I prefer that you could come back and give us a very brief summary of what's occurred. And pick up from there.
Okay, fine.
And if you need a half hour, it'll be available. Will that do it for you? May I have another half hour?
Well, we don't even need that long.
And Mr. Kennedy's going to be back then. Sorry, Evan. Were there other witnesses here today to testify? On this subject, the committee will continue on February 15 at 8:30 a.m. Thank you very much, and I'm sorry for the problems.